You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Live from the Del Close Marathon, this is the UCB Long-Form Conversations Podcast. Yes. What's up, DCM?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Oh. For those of you listening at home, you don't know it, but it's Sunday afternoon. Everybody's exhausted. Everybody's hungover. And we're about to do a fun, high-concept improv podcast in a giant room. So we're really excited about this. Yeah.
So
you've all tuned into a really special episode of the Longform Conversations podcast because today we are at DCM and we are paying tribute to our friend Timmy Wood, who passed away just over a month ago. We lost him too soon. Timmy was longtime UCB family, right?
Yeah.
He's been around forever.
Performer, writer, all-around good guy, and the kind of guy who loved DCM. He loved DCM.
He loved this community. He loved being around people, getting people together. That was his whole thing.
I think any chance to just bring anybody together. That was like it. And DCM, that's what DCM is kind of about when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And high concept things like passing around a DCM book and like doing, what's the Santa thing he does? Like the gift exchange?
No, the gift exchange.
That's how AJ and I met each other.
Yeah, we lived together.
We got paired together.
We're roommates now.
You guys met that way?
Yeah, we met that way.
So for everybody listening at home, you can't see the folks who are on this panel, but with us today on the far side here is Louis Vega.
Party space,
Louis Vega. AJ Patton's in the middle.
Hi.
And Devin Ritchie's here as well.
Hi.
And we're waiting for Bill DiPiero. He's going to jump in on this as soon as he arrives. But we're essentially here today actually to continue a tradition that Timmy started at DCM a couple DCMs ago. Timmy started this project called the DCM Novel. And so he had a black-bound notebook, right? Mm-hmm. And he started it by writing the first page in the notebook, and then like an exquisite corpse-style project, the notebook passed itself around this very party space and around the marathon for 3 days, and you got to see the last person's page and write your page. And then you passed it on to the next person who repeated the same process. And this notebook filled up.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. People were dying to get their hands on it.
Yeah, people were like waiting, writing in corners at the party space.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a really fun project, and it's the kind of thing that is very a testament to sort of Timmy, again, what we're saying about his love for this community and for this festival, and sort of something that felt like it was a different application of the sort of creativity that sort of is abounding here, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
They performed the 16 one last year, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did a reading.
Yeah, it was bonkers.
It's a rambling mess.
Well... And so what we actually have here today is the DCM 18 novel. We don't have to wait any longer.
Oh, no,
we're unveiling the DCM
over,
18
folks.
Novel
finished. It's published.
Right
Bringing
now.
It out.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The book is done. It is here in front of us.
That's
it is definitely
edition.
Right
we're,
in front
we're
of us.
We're all looking at a hard copy of this real-life book that exists.
I just blew dust off of it, and I'm opening it up.
So it's definitely a book that's in our hands right now.
It's dusty as well, as Devin said, so there's a little bit of dust on it.
It's been passed around. It's definitely what we're going to do is definitely not improvise this novel.
No.
We're not going to use an exquisite corpse mechanism of improv where the people who are not improvising are wearing soundproof headphones.
How would we even do that?
Yeah,
and
that's
sort
crazy.
Of humming to themselves because the soundproof headphones that I bought aren't quite good enough.
It seems like that would work.
But
that's not what we're doing.
Mate, you're talking like a crazy guy.
Insane for me to even say because this is a physical book that is right here in my hand.
I see it.
And we are going to read it to you guys in its entirety for the next 45 minutes. You excited about that, DCM?
Yeah.
You can't hear it on the cans,
it's
but
palpable.
The crowd is going
the
wild.
The excitement is palpable.
People are eating Chinese food. They're very pacified right now. So you know.
All right. So without further ado, folks, in honor of Timmy Wood, we present. Yep. And Louis, you're going to read the first page. So here you go. I'm going to pass it over to you, Louis.
I'll kick it off.
So the book is titled, and appropriately, Defook.
Defook.
Defook. The book is called Defook.
Defook. DCM 18. I stood on a parapet, sun glistening with dust. I looked down, and I saw at my feet, my shirt, my pants, my socks. I had my underwear on, but everything else was off. It was around my ankles. I looked around me. I looked around me. Yeah, that's what that says. And I touched the wall. I touched the wall and I hit the light switch. Lights came on, blaring in my eyes. I saw I was in an abandoned party space. I was the only person there, looked around. I only saw other people's clothing. My first thought, have I been raptured? Is this the rapture?
It upon further inspection, I could see crosses hanging on all the walls, a lot of old wood, some pews stacked up in the corner. It became pretty obvious that this party space had at one point been a church. I don't know what kind of church. I don't know exactly who or what they were worshiping in this church. But it was certainly some sort of religious building, which made it a little more spooky. Being in this empty building. So I pulled my pants up, tightened my belt, and began to take stock of my surroundings. The air felt heavy and wet, as if there was a fog machine going 24/7. The building itself felt a little shaky, as if it was being moved around.
Daddy, I heard in the distance. I turned around. There she was. I thought she was lost in the storm. She ran to me with her arms open wide, with new scars on her eyes. Why did this happen? What has happened here? I don't know. But we're gonna find them and figure this out. Just then, a piece of rock fell off the building. They nearly dodged it. They see a gold chain twinkle in the concrete. They move a mossy rock and discover that a gold shiny necklace. It has a large gem on it. This is clearly an amulet of power that I've heard about.
Picking up the gold amulet, they felt a certain power come over them. It was a distinct feeling inside that she felt change herself physically, and suddenly muscles started to grow on her arms. It was like a Hulk thing. She hulked right out. Clothing ripping to shreds, muscles building, anger coming over her. And suddenly she remembered. She had a vision of her parents dying when she was a child, taken too soon by a masked murderer. She thought to herself, I now will find this murderer. I must. And so she left that place and got on an airplane home to a childhood home in Cleveland. It was still very similar to the way it had been left when she had left there as a child. In fact, it was still an active crime scene. Because in Cleveland, you know, all crime scenes stay active until the crime is solved. And no one had yet solved this crime. She was too big to fit in the airplane seat because she was still hulked out, so she had to buy two seats, which is an unfortunate policy. But she got double the frequent flyer miles, so it was all right. And so she arrived back in Cleveland, ready to solve the murder. End of chapter one.
Chapter two, Cleveland rocks. She got off the plane. She greeted the cab driver, had her name. Remember, she's still hulked out. She's got muscles glowing left and right. She's sweating because she was doing a creatine powder on the plane. She gets off the plane. Cleveland rocks, the guy says to her. And she thinks, Cleveland rocks? I haven't been here in years. Also, what's going on here? And he says, hey, watch where you're stepping. There's an active crime scene. She says, hey, take me back to 4971, I think is what's written here. 4971 909 Street. Take me back. I need to get back to find who murdered my parents and step on it.
It had been keeping her awake the entire plane ride. She turns to creatine when she can't sleep. It truly is her happy place ever since the passing of her dear mom and dad. They were lost, as so many people their age, drowning when the Titanic sunk. The Titanic being a giant airplane that landed, could land on water, and did land on the water, but then sank. It was named after the ship, the Titanic. She cried the entire way back to her house, thinking about all the good times they had, but also crying about the bad times. They were happy tears, and they were sad tears.
What will my Titanic be, she thought. What is my generation going to deal with? How are they going to wipe us out? Am I living in my Titanic right now? I never thought I would become a pilot, but then again, that's just what my father told me. I need them. I need them near me. Once I get to the farm, I will need their help to grow the corn. Caw, caw! A bird flew by. But it's not a bird that I've seen around these parts before. Much larger, with fire and wings like a dragon. Its scales were hard and angular. I have to know this beast, I thought, once I get to the farm.
Oh, how she longed for the farm. The memory of it was etched into her brain. The hot summer days, the cool winter nights, summer and autumn, which were somewhere in between emotionally. She thought about those memories. And then she thought, Brian Jones, the boy who got away. Maybe he had something to do with this mystery. So she sought him out. She got in her car, a 1994 Dodge Pinto. Bright red, the V8 engine. The V8 in the cup holder. You always got to drink a V8 in a V8. And she decided to drive over to Brian's house. Only it wasn't Brian's house anymore. It was a shelter for abused dogs. End of chapter two.
Chapter three, who let the dogs out? She had three sharp knocks on the door. A stoutly woman came to answer the door, sweating and worried. She's been busy.
She had been busy. And she said, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry. I used to know somebody who lived here. Brian Jones. He's a boy who got away. Do you know anything about him? As a previous owner of this house, I understand this is now an abused... it's not an abused home, but it's a shelter for abused dogs. Is my information correct? And she said, yes, I'm busy here. Well, I think I know Brian Jones. He moved over next to the Denny's. So she said, okay. By the way, I've been looking to get a pup.
So I did. I grabbed one right there, one of those sweet little animals. I picked it up, I hopped on my horse, and I rode over to the Denny's. The whole time I found myself wondering, why Denny's? This is such an iffy part of town. I mean, it was once really nice, back in the 50s, but I don't know, ever since people started moving out of the city, things had been bad over on that area. Just, you know, not super bad in any particular way, just like, you kind of got uneasy when you were around there, you know? You got a certain feeling in your tummy, like, ooh, maybe I shouldn't be here. Before he knew it, he was at the Denny's. It's a quick ride, especially with a horse. You don't have to worry about traffic in the same way you do with a car. As he dismounted his horse, a giant falcon swooped down and grabbed the horse.
Chapter 2. This is when shit gets really crazy. Do you ever feel like you love somebody, but they don't love you back? I'm not sure I'll ever know what love is. I see everybody in couples around me, and is that real? Are you guys actually in love? Is that an untangible thing that I can't even imagine sitting here by myself in the corner at the party space? Really? Is this something I'm gonna have to do for the rest of my life? Gotta expose all of my feelings for somebody else to just love? And that's just so easy for, like, everybody in the entire world. I guess I'm going to go... He got to the dentist. And
this was an effort to fix himself. Sometimes when you don't find love, you wonder, who do you blame? Is it me or is it everyone else in the world? Am I the one at fault? Maybe my teeth are wrong. And if I could just fix them up, or even just give them a once-over, I'd be better off. So he walks into the dentist. The dentist assistant has him sit down. And she smiles at him. Maybe a little longer than he was hoping, but just enough to give him that little boost and think, you know, maybe there is a chance for me after all. And I think I could floss if this was what was on the table. So she reached over and had him spit.
She reached over and spit. Now, this was the dentist spitting, so it was weird, because usually the patient's supposed to spit. Now, she said, hey, take your shirt off, for God's sake. We're going to need to clean you up. And he thought, this can't be. This isn't how I wanted this to go down. I came here to fix my teeth. I came here to find love. I wanted to find love here, to really figure it out once and for all. And he looked her in the face and he said, Doc, are my teeth too long? And she said, baby, your teeth are just right.
He'd been waiting all his life to hear those words. He made it his goal that day to make that dentist his wife. There would never be another waking moment in his life where he didn't think of the dentist. He thought of the dentist when he woke up. He thought of the dentist, obviously, while he was brushing his teeth. But he also thought about the dentist in moments where maybe somebody wouldn't normally think of a dentist. Eating sticky candy. Or maybe that is also a time you'd think of the dentist. It's hard to say what exactly brought about the thoughts of the dentist to his mind, but he knew that she'd be there forever, and that she was the only one who could love his long, disgusting teeth. The only one who thought, those teeth will be my teeth someday.
So the dentist is kind of like the doctor in that she's a time lord. And he said to the dentist, let's be bad. So they went to the candy store, the big one that looks like Willy Wonka's candy factory. And there's a chocolate river and like lollipops and candy canes and shit. And he's like, I know you love my disgusting weird teeth and this is gonna be so bad for them. But like, you're only on this timeline for a short time, dentist. And I just wanna fuck you with this candy. And fuck they did. And it was a sticky mess. There's peppermint everywhere. His long, sticky teeth runs over her supple breast and nearly sticks to it with the amount of sugar.
This was a sticky, disgusting sight. And then he said to the dentist, we fucked in this candy store. But do you want to do something you really can't take back? Are you ready to walk down a road of unforgivable acts? Here in front of this whole candy store, this is a place where people go to escape. This is where people go for a sweet treat, a little break from all the tough stuff in life. And the dentist said, whoosh, she got sucked back up. And her role as Time Lord continued, and she jumped back into another dimension. The dentist zipped and zapped, no longer a dentist, but now an entity free of time and space, waiting to be rejoined to a new person. End of chapter.
Chapter 5. Time, time, time again. She was there in the candy store, dripping wet with candy and moisture. And she thought, what happened to me here? The Time Lord is gone. What am I doing here? I gotta find Steve Jones, the person who murdered my parents. I gotta find him. I gotta find him. He wasn't the dentist who I ended up fucking. It wasn't that. It wasn't that person. I need to find this person. Where do I go? Where do I turn? I'll start at the Denny's. Maybe if I get a little bit of food in me, I'll figure something out. So he went to the Denny's, and he said, table for one, please. And she said, absolutely.
She led him to a shadowy booth in the corner. Out of nowhere, the Time Lord appeared. Sorry I'm late. Or am I late? He whispered, almost to himself. She didn't know what to make of it, but she was happy to see him. Over the years, the Time Lord had become one of her only friends, one of the only people she could confide in regularly, her deepest thoughts and fears, from what happens when you die to what happens to your hamster when it dies. She ran the gambit of thoughts with him. They sat down and ordered 2 grand sandwiches, as was their tradition. And then they began talking. He asked her, why have you been waiting so long? What exactly are you waiting for? She said, the same thing I've always been waiting for.
I want a child. I don't want any child. I want the golden baby. And you're gonna get it for me. I have $1 million in this suitcase and a helicopter right on the roof of this Denny's. And I've got a plan we can execute right now. Now tell me one thing. Are you fucking in? And he says, I'll have one more picky for my ticky. Let's get out of this timeline. They jetpack out of the Denny's and straight to their helicopter. They tie their seatbelts like they do in the beginning of Jurassic Park. Life finds a way, they said. Life finds a way.
So they take off looking for a golden baby. Sometimes you look around in life and you're like, maybe a child would make things better. I got $1 million, a jetpack that can take me to a helicopter. And a true aphorism, life finds a way. So they start hunting for a top-notch baby. They land at New York Presbyterian on the roof and, and infiltrate the maternity ward. They rolled down, and they said, you know what I want? I want a baby who's been through something. I don't want a baby. A true golden baby is like a Harry Potter baby who's seen some stuff. So they stroll into the NICU in slow-mo, knowing that there they're going to find someone who's truly lived.
They look around the ward, and an attendant comes by, and they both say, give me the most damaged baby you got here. A baby who's seen his parents die. A baby who doesn't have an arm. Something like that. Give me the most damaged baby you got. The woman looks at him, and she smiles, and she said, I've had a long shift, and I have just the baby for you. I'm going to take my smoke break. I'll look the other way. You can take this baby. No paperwork. It looks like you guys need a baby bad. Sometimes life finds a way, and it just takes a little golden baby to make everything right. It's going to be in crib number 47. You're going to see it on the outside. They're numbered. I'm going to go take a smoke break. Good luck with this baby.
They walk down the countless aisles of babies in the baby ward. Finally, they found the baby they were looking for. No damage to the naked eye, had all its limbs, seemed to be breathing properly. And then it stood up and it spoke. Are you my mom and my dad? They knew at this point that this baby had been tampered with. This baby had been experimented on. This baby was part of some sort of sick science experiment. It was exactly the kind of fucked up baby they were hoping for. They took it home. They nodded to the nurse as she finished her cigarette and put it out with the heel of her boot. They walked hand in hand with the baby walking next to them. This baby was like a grown-up in every single way.
He's big like a grown-up. He's like just as tall. And he's an adult. I'm pretty clear this baby is an adult man who's been experimented on. Finally, it's complete, I said. So we marched onward to the volcano, knowing full well this is where it would end. And this part is a Lost flashback, like they do in Lost. Hey, you get off this ship. I was told to come on this ship. My father's a fisherman. I don't know anything about that. You better get off my ship. So he showed him his passport, and the fisherman looked shocked.
The fisherman was so shocked. He was startled even after seeing the passport. And then we flash back forward to present time, having learned a lot from that Lost style flashback. They walk into the volcano. Couple and the adult baby. Looking for a sign of what to do. And they remember the Lord of the Rings, when Gollum bites that finger. And they're like, all right, guys, everyone be cool. Don't be greedy right now, because that's gonna be your downfall. Because they're standing in the middle, like out on a little ledge, surrounded by volcano, lava bubbling below them, magma boiling over. And the baby goes, you know what? This is my purpose, and dives headfirst into the volcano.
The baby throws himself, as an adult baby, throws himself into the volcano. Hot lava bubbles bursting all around him. The two watch him fall as he dives into the volcano, and they look at each other and they say, this is right. This is why we got this fucked up adult baby, so this baby could die in a volcano. But the baby hits the volcano and he doesn't burn. He stands on top of the lava and he looks up at them and he says, I am God. I am a God, baby. I am an adult baby. I wasn't born right, and I will rule the world. I will.
Suddenly a voice rang out from the heavens. Who claims to be God in this volcano? The voice cried. It appeared as though the God baby had disrupted some sort of cosmic order. Being born in a laboratory, he has no spirit. He only has the will to destroy and to take over. Who dares disturb me? Cries the voice again. The God baby looks up and he flicks off the clouds. He assumes it's the clouds talking because he is smart and full grown, you know, adult baby, God baby, but, you know, he doesn't know anything about God in any sense. I guess it was God who was talking down to him, the big God. Suddenly a ray of light appeared next to the volcano, and a man, half horse, came down from the heavens.
It's his father. He came to talk some sense into the God baby one last time before he tried to take over the universe and defeat the Volcano King. You were never supposed to be like this. You were supposed to be the you were supposed to be the bastion of hope in this new world. You aren't a god. The God baby said, I am a god. What does it mean to be a god? Like, what does it mean, you know? Because, like, I'm a god, and you're a god. And even in an afterlife sort of sense, I feel like I am a god. Like, I feel like that is going to revolve around me in some sense. And I don't think that's weird to say. I think everybody's a fucking queen, and everybody's a fucking god, you know? And that's cool.
Yeah, that's what this is about. We're all gods, whether we're god babies, volcano kings, or we're just some people who had helicoptered over from a Denny's. All around, everybody has a little spark of the divine in them, and that's what makes this whole crazy globe spin round and round. And the volcano king comes up. He's like, are you ready to bow down and be my subjects? And they said, no, we're not. Because in fact, in this world, we're all equals, equally divine. And the Volcano King said, you know what? Never thought of it like that. And he took his crown and he threw it into the flames. And they all hugged, knowing that they had made a difference in one king's life today. End of chapter.
Chapter 9. Defook? The Volcano King's crown burst into flames. Suddenly, the couple and the adult baby god were transported out of the volcano. They looked around, and they were in the DCM 18 party space at Sunwest Studios. They looked around, and they said, why are we here? How do we even get here? And the baby god said, sometimes that's just the way it goes. And he pulled out a spliff. And he lit a spliff in the middle of a DCM party space. And he passed it around and he said, take a hit and pass it on. We got to live this life. We don't have enough time to figure out what's going on. We got to enjoy ourselves while we have it.
They all knew there was something funny about the spliff they were smoking. But they didn't realize exactly what it was until they'd seen that they'd all turned into rabbits. Small rabbits, identical to each other. It became quickly evident that they weren't going to be able to keep track of who was who. Everybody who had hit that spliff was a little tiny bunny rabbit. They started mixing each other up and having a lot of awkward conversations. Ex-lovers talking as if they were best friends, old friends talking as if they were parents and children. It was an entirely messy situation. But the rabbits ran. If there's one thing rabbits can do, it's they can run.
And they ran and they ran and they ran. To the sky, they said. This is where it all ends. They brought drugs into our town, and they're gonna regret it. Drugs haven't been in our town in hundreds of years. When we made that law, this is like that town from Footloose. And my dad's pissed. Somebody's riding the bunny, and he says, I actually like the drugs. And they, like, screech stop. And everybody's like, what? We hate that. And he's like, yeah, but I come from a place where drugs are grown, and I think they're beautiful, and you should have some. And the bunnies remembered that they all got high. And they went back to town.
So the bunnies are back to town. Fresh with the knowledge that they're in a Footloose type world where drugs are outlawed, like most societies and civilizations. But knowing that there is a place of milk and honey and drugs that works. They grow it there. So the bunny said, let's go down the rabbit hole. Like Alice. Let's see what Alice saw. So the bunnies do what they did. They got a glass and they mashed up their drugs. They just went for a combo, like a real suicide mashup of stuff. And just went for it. And the visions came quick, and they were overwhelming. And the bunnies saw things that they were not expecting to ever see.
We're talking about acid. We're talking about weed. We're talking about cocaine. We're talking about hashish. This drug cocktail had everything, and the bunnies smoked it up and they put it an IV in their veins, and the visions they saw were horrifying, and they understood life in a deeper level. They understood it in a truer sense. These bunnies knew the meaning of life, and they knew just what to do to get this footloose town back on track, to get the people who don't want them to have drugs to allow them to have drugs. These bunnies were ready to get their hands on these drugs no matter what it took. Legalize drugs, they said together. Legalize drugs. Let's go to the mayor's.
To the mayor's ball. They forged their tickets to the mayor's ball and walked in with their sweet cocktail of all the drugs imaginable. They spiked the punch. They spiked it real good. And they stood by the bowl and they beckoned people. They said, "Ooh, come pet us, we're sweet bunnies. Ooh, have some of this punch, it's so tasty. Ooh, ooh, ooh." Things got weird after that. People began walking around on all fours, talking to each other like they were from outer space. "Bloop, bloop, beep, boop, boop," said one man to another. The other man nodded knowingly. They understood each other. In this weird way, this terrifying, dangerous drug cocktail had really brought everybody together.
In the criminal justice system, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. In New York City, the dedicated detectives who investigate these vicious felonies are members of an elite squad known as the Special Victims Unit, and this is their story. Benson and Stabler knocked down the doors, and they scared all the bunnies off, and all the bunnies are hiding behind curtains, and Stabler's looking as hot as ever, and it's just like, "I knew something fishy was up here in the mayor's office," and he grabs one bunny by the head and just shoots it as an example. So they know he means business, and Benson's like, you're getting too hot, man. You're getting too hot." And he's like, "I know what I'm doing. I like love my daughters." And and Benson is like, "Okay, let me go talk to him."
So he pulled over his daughters, who came with him, who came over for the ride along. They knew that this would be one that they would want to see. And he said, and Stabler's like, Benson and Stabler's like, "Don't be special victims. We're gonna be special crime busters here. And we're gonna show these bunnies justice." And the bunnies, having just seen their friend shot, were like, "Please don't. Don't make another example of us for your children." But Benson wasn't having that. He killed all the bunnies. But that's not the end of their story, because all of those bunnies were gods. And their souls zoom back into the stream, waiting to spin and be spit out in another Time Lord type situation.
The end.
Wow. Wow.
My God.
I'm impressed by all the writers we have in the community.
So many talented writers.
Some of this
writers.
Stuff, I tell you, I was reading it. I was like, no way did someone write this down.
Yeah. No way.
But they did.
But they did.
So that is the DCM 18 novel called DaFook. Come back next year for another novel, the DCM 19 novel. The tradition lives on. Thank you guys for doing this thing. Bill, you came in maybe like the third round. Yeah.
Happy to be part of at least that two-thirds of it.
Hey, you snuck in effortlessly, though. It was effortless.
Very fun. And thank you guys for joining us.
That'll
do it for another episode of the UCB Longform Conversations Podcast. Goodbye!
Bye.
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 You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.